Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Let's talk about that ugly data out of Europe just to begin with.
I think this really brings forward
an ECB decision from September to tomorrow.
John, you're the first person to say that. I totally agree.
Let's bring in Michael McKee, Bloomberg International Economics and Policy Correspondent. Your thoughts, Mike?
Well, let me be the second person to say that. It could easily bring forward the decision. The problem that they have is, what are they going to do? Which tool are they going to use, and how are they going to set that up? Presumably, they've been working on that for some time. But the hope was that Draghi could float some ideas and see how they would play and see what kind of impact that might have in the markets. And they would have to forego that sort of preliminary testing period if they go ahead and move it. But you're right, the number is so bad. German manufacturing, the flash PMI, 43. And that signals significant contraction in manufacturing that is definitely going to be a drag on growth there.
Mike, the parallel, the analog to the United States is a linkage of the service sector economy to what's clearly a manufacturing recession. Is their service sector economy the same as our service sector economy?
Well, their manufacturing is a much bigger component of the German economy. But yes, they have a large services component to their economy, and the services sector is hanging in there. Their PMI for services, 55.4, that's a trivial change from what it was a month ago. It's not services, it's manufacturing, and a lot of that has to do with trade. Germany is one of the biggest trading nations in the world, and with China sort of shut down and the U.S. engaged in a trade war with them. You've got a lot of other nations that are engaged in mini trade skirmishes. It's tough for Germany.
Those trade talks can't begin fast enough for the likes of Germany and Europe. The United States and officials heading over to Beijing, I believe,
Shanghai, to be correct.
Thank you, Mike.
Which is significant in and of itself. The Chinese are basically saying trade is trade. Let's keep it out of the politics for now, because the politics between the U.S. and I'm sure Bob will know more about this, politics between the U.S. and China, not very good right now. But if they can focus on the trade numbers and the trade negotiations and try to work on that, it does signal they're maybe farther away from getting somewhere, but at least they're starting.
Let's bring in Bob Holmatt, shall we? Kissinger Associates Vice Chair. Bob, you know a little something about Germany. I'd love your thoughts on it. We're now looking at the water levels in the River Rhine, which to anyone outside of Europe sounds absolutely ridiculous. But the weather has been so dry, so hot over in Europe that it's actually becoming an economic issue. Bob, your knowledge on the country, your knowledge on that area, just walk us through how significant that is.
Well, it is significant. I lived for a summer in Bonn, which was then the capital of what was then West Germany. And the Rhine is really the major artery for a lot of trade that goes from the western part of Germany through to Rotterdam and other ports and then to other parts of the world. So the Rhine is very important. And the trade link with China that Mike talked about a moment ago is also critically important. We talk in this country blithely about decoupling and delinking with China. China is an integral part of the manufacturing network in Europe and in the United States as well. And a weaker China, which we've seen their growth diminishing rather substantially, not disastrously, but certainly lower than it was. And that affects their demand for manufactured goods from Europe and from the United States as well. So some normalization of economic relations and alleviation of the threat of higher tariffs and perhaps even reducing the tariffs and improving the investment environment in China would be very helpful to the Europeans. It would take time, but it would have an impact on the markets,
just
a positive one.
The limited time that we have with you today, Ambassador, is extraordinary. I am really taken aback by the diversity of the proposed cabinet or speculated cabinet of Prime Minister Johnson. It truly, to me, seems to be a generational shift in the United Kingdom.
Yes. Well, he's got an interesting agenda. One is, he is, and if you look at the Tory party, there it is a much more diverse party than it was 10 years ago, and he wants to be able to pick people who represent various elements of the Tory party. But basically, on one issue, he's going to get a lot of leavers, people who want a Brexit. And so he's going to be diversified ethnically and culturally, but on the question of Brexit, he's going to want to have relatively hardliners to give credibility.
Well, Pretty Patel, he has that. But John, it's extraordinary. An Indian family that went to Uganda, thrown out of India, whenever it was. We've got a Pakistani possibly appointed.
Well, the Times actually just reporting the headline crossing the Bloomberg that Sajid Javid may be the Chancellor of the UK government.
But
I don't think that will be news to many people, that story.
It's not news, but for Americans, the diversity proposed is unprecedented. There's no equivalent in the United States.
I actually think the Conservative Party has done a really good job of bringing minority figures into the forefront of the party. And we could well see that in the Boris Johnson cabinet in quite a big way.
It's just absolutely extraordinary.
And it's healthy for Britain. And I think it's healthy for Britain in the world because it enables them to have these links with other countries.
How does Boris Johnson attend to the President of the United States? We've heard in the last hours they may visit three times to September.
Well, I think Boris Johnson wants to, A, demonstrate to his people that he can work with the United States. B, he's going to want to develop some closer economic ties with the EU, even if there is a hard Brexit. He wants to make sure that there's some kind of trade deal. But if he cannot get that, then he's going to have some deal with the United States on trade. They're going to need that.
Mike, I mean, well, you're a trade expert.
He sold his candidacy in part on the idea that we can leave the European Union with no real ill effects because we'll immediately be able to put together a trade deal with the United States. Okay. They haven't been legally allowed to negotiate because they're still part of the EU, but they've still been talking on the sidelines for quite some time.
It's still true that Europe's his biggest trading partner, so finding some deal on trade with Europe's important. But if he can work with the United States, it strengthens his leverage with the Europeans. And if he can't get a deal, he's going to want a good deal with the U.S. The question is, will the United States, in the way it negotiates, give him a really good deal?
Yeah.
And that's going to be a challenge.
We're going to continue a five-hour discussion with Robert Hormats today. We'll try to get to that as well. Alicia Levine with us, BNY Mellon. Alicia, I want to go right to the terminal rate. Everything's squeezing down. John mentioning the negative rates in Europe as well. You're supposed to flip the reciprocal and get a higher PE. What's the new 12 multiple? I mean, value stocks were very 12-y. Right. Is it 15 or is it 18?
So I'm not going to put a number on it, but it's
Come on. You work for a bank? Put a number on it.
Not the sell side. You know, look, it's higher. It's clearly higher. When your rates are lower, your discount rate is lower, your multiple is higher, and markets go up. And we see that not just in the U.S., but also globally, which is why markets don't feel frothy. They feel more or less fairly valued, but not frothy.
John, frothy, CFA level four.
That's level four?
Frothy.
Not level five, level four.
Frothy.
I was listening to Andrew Sheets of Morgan Stanley quite recently, and he makes a really interesting point.
Please.
They make it very simple over at Morgan Stanley. We're going to get easing. That is the consensus view in the market right now. What is the accompanying data? Does it continue to weaken? Does it stabilize? Or does it accelerate? And that's the real judgment call here as to what is about to happen with risk assets. And right now, the Andrew Sheets take on this, and Alicia, I'd love your insight on it as well, is that if this market was betting beyond just easing and to something like sustainable economic growth, why aren't inflation expectations higher? Why aren't commodities rallying across the whole complex? And why aren't long-end rates pushing higher as well? Why aren't we factoring in those things if we believe these central banks can engineer a better growth picture?
Look, it's a great question, and we've had this discussion now for several weeks, which is, what actually is the transition mechanism between lower rates and economic growth? And if you look at Germany and you look at Europe and the ECB, that's the perfect example of the muddy nature of it and how it's not actually a direct transmission. Because if you look at the PMIs coming out of Germany today, it's very clear that negative rates actually have not helped the economy or manufacturing or investment or anything of the sort. So we come back to America and ask the question, what can the central bank here do by easing? Clearly, it's going to be in the interest rate sectors, interest rate sensitive sectors of the economy, housing and autos. Autos have their own issue because there's a structural change going on in auto ownership. We can see that in ride sharing, but we should see it there first. The other issue is on the yield question. If we think growth is stabilizing and turning, you cannot escape the global negative yield here in the U.S. And you have $13 trillion of negative yielding debt, and that's going to come into America. And you can't engineer your way out of it. It's capital flows.
Well, let's talk about earnings quickly as well. Caterpillar delivering results, I believe, in about 8 minutes' time. Looking at the semis, semis have had a massive run over the last couple of days. Taiwan Semi, I believe, last week came out with some pretty decent numbers relative to an ugly expectation looking forward. I believe Texas Instruments did the same thing after the close yesterday. Your take on that area of the market right now?
I think it's interesting. What the semis are telling you is that cyclicals are the play here. And the U.S. data is interesting because the U.S. data in June clearly was better than April or May. So you have a turn here in the U.S. The semis are saying that you play the cyclicals because they're the forward-looking. They're the forward-looking sector. This is really the interesting thing here. While everybody's so worried about growth falling apart, corporates are coming in pretty decent.
Are you happy advising clients right now to add a little bit more cyclicality to their portfolios, given the economic data we're seeing elsewhere?
I am, actually. And I am because you don't fight central banks. So you have the Fed, you've got the ECB, you've got other central banks already easing as of last week. So you have to play into that. Your multiple is higher. You support corporates. You can't go bankrupt in Europe. How are you going to go bankrupt? The ECB is buying every bond out there.
We're too short. We've got to come back. Alicia,
Alicia, thank you.
BNY Mellon for another visit here soon. Some optimism out there. And darkening the door right now, Timothy O'Brien spearheading with David Shipley, all that is Bloomberg Opinion. Many of you have seen him waxing philosophical in Washington, and this morning we begin by speaking to Mr. O'Brien about these Mueller hearings. The photo this week out on Twitter of a lieutenant in Vietnam, and there was another photo of the president doing whatever he was doing at the time. Do we really know who Robert Mueller is? I mean, do we have a clue who's actually going to be the focus of attention in Washington this morning?
Yeah. Robert Mueller is a by-the-books prosecutor. He follows the rules. He's a long-standing, classic Republican conservative. He's well-read.
Then why can't this president get along with him?
Well, because it's not about politics. You know, Trump doesn't like the fact that Mueller stewarded an investigation that potentially could have gone into an exploration of Trump's finances, but certainly looked obviously at what happened during the 2016 campaign and Trump's team's interactions with Russians. He didn't like any of that because it was an existential threat.
So, Tim, we have two hearings today. One starts rather early for Washington, the House Judiciary Committee hearing beginning at 8:30 Eastern.
O'Brien hasn't been up this early in 3 months.
Tim's in New York here at Bloomberg. Tim is still getting up early.
He's
don't worry about
Washington
that.
Hours.
I'm not going to pay attention to Tom. Can you ask me a question, please?
Tim, let's talk about it. What are you expecting? What are you expecting from this? Because so many of our listeners are just thinking about this. So I've got hours of testimony, perhaps. Do I tune in?
Well, here's the thing. The Mueller report is an extraordinary document. It's 448 pages long, and it is one of the most incriminating documents ever put together about a sitting president. Here's the other reality. Most of the country and most politicians have not read it. So one of the things that's important about today is it's political theater. This is the power of TV and radio to broadcast something that people aren't reading, with the idea that they might engage with it. So to the extent that this brings the Mueller report into people's living rooms, it's important. And we've seen that before over the last year. We saw it with Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court. We saw it with Michael Cohen's hearings. People really engaged with those. Having said that, I do feel like a little bit of light has run out of the lamp. I think people are sort of in a PTSD state with Trump. And I don't know how much more generally people want to absorb. So I think this will be a litmus test of that today.
But let's explore that a little bit further. The idea that this is about almost defining the perceptions or shaping the perceptions of the Mueller report. You've written this morning the role that Attorney General William Barr has had. You've written about that this morning, that he's almost defined, he's shaped the perception, perhaps more so than the individual that wrote it. Just walk us through the importance of that, Tim.
Yeah, you know, this isn't Bill Barr's first rodeo. He was an attorney general for George H.W. Bush in the early 1990s when the Iran-Contra investigation was underway. And he was very shrewd about how he protected the president during that investigation. So he had been there before. And I think he came into this with a playbook. And I think his playbook was he was going to define what the report was about before Bob Mueller or anyone else did, including the Democrats. And what Bill Barr said was there is no collusion. There's no criminal conspiracy. The president wasn't fully exonerated, and Bob Mueller made no ruling on obstruction of justice, so I will. He didn't obstruct. And that basically became, you've gotten a clean bill of health, Mr. President, even though that's not what the report says. And Barr really stayed by that. You know, when the report was finally released in full, he had a press conference the day it came out, and he said a lot of misleading things about what was in the report. So, you know, Barr has been an ally of the president, and has really run interference for him on this.
Is Mr. Mueller a private citizen today? Is he a yes. employee of the government? Is he
no.
have a legacy to the Department of Justice? Is there a code that he has to
I think he has a personal code. There is not an institutional code.
There's not a DOJ code or FBI code.
Nope, he resigned in May. They shut his office down, I believe, in late May. So he's no longer employed by the Justice Department. This letter he sought this week from the Justice Department offering guidance about what he could say.
Noah Feldman wrote up.
My colleague, Noah Feldman, who knows about all things legal, said that it's not a legally binding letter. I think Mueller asked for it because it's yet another indication that Mueller really wants, he does not want to testify in public about what he regards as a private investigation.
What are these shining lights of our American politics going to do when he says, it's not going to be the drama, I plead the Fifth Amendment, but he's going to say, I don't want to answer that.
Correct. So I think what they're going to have to probably do is ask him to read passages from the report. And there's some really extraordinary passages in there where Trump is asking his
They're going to force Mr. Mueller to do that?
He's a citizen. He's appearing before the Congress. He should do what they ask him to do, include read from the document.
And now beyond that, of course, this is going to dominate the headlines in Washington, D.C. Something that's attracted a lot of attention from our listeners here at Bloomberg, Tim, is what is happening with the DOJ and big tech. Some people are struggling to get their head around the idea that the United States is involved in a trade dispute with the Chinese and also simultaneously going after some of the big tech firms here in the United States.
Right.
Tim, can you reconcile those two things for us?
Well, you know, as business journalists, I find this schizophrenia in the Trump administration curious. And it often feels to me like where they are on policy is a little bit shoot from the hip. And you don't know where the inputs are coming from. You know, as you just said, he came into office as a champion of business. He had a tech council meet at Trump Tower with the head of the Fangs and other leading CEOs. Now he's authorized, it would appear, an antitrust investigation.
You are considered, Timothy O'Brien, the expert on the president's previous finances. I believe in the last 24 hours, he's saying, I want my state tax returns to be private in New York. He's reasserting that he doesn't want his state tax returns.
He's not only saying it, he's suing as a private citizen to prevent them
what
being
are in
released.
Those, are those returns the same as the federal returns?
They're not. They don't have the same depth as the federal returns, but they have a lot of the same information directionally. Obviously, I think what people want to see is what kind of income he has from abroad and any possible malfeasance that might be inside the documents
and
themselves.
To be clear, Governor Cuomo passed legislation to allow this. The president is saying, no, as a citizen, we're not going to do this. What would you suggest will be the outcome?
I don't think the courts are going to be on the president's side in this.
Interesting.
You know, they've made a similar, you know, slate of arguments about access to his financial records and other records. And his argument has been these are political efforts and therefore they should be knocked down. And the Congress has said we're exercising oversight per the Constitution. Mm-hmm. The courts have tended to side with Congress on that.
What will you look for the rest of the summer from the president? We've been talking here about it's been almost two administrations in a first term. There's been such turnover and all. What's sort of your crystal ball into the cooling months of September and October?
Well, he doesn't have cooling months, so
he's going to meet with Prime Minister Johnson. I mean, we know that.
Yeah, I think that you know, Iran and North Korea have to remain sort of front and center
in
people's minds. The southern border remains unresolved. What's going to happen with immigration policy there? And then I think obviously he's positioning for 2020. And you know, there's going to be some key issues that the Republicans have to pull together on to have an agenda behind him beyond just Trump the showman. And I think they've got to figure out where they are on health care, where they are on immigration. Yeah. and make sure that the fruits of their tax cut are apparent to their supporters.
You're going to stay and listen to the testimony live here on Bloomberg Radio?
I want to watch you translate it for me, Tom.
I would love that.
That would be sporting. If you read the document, full disclosure, I have not read the
document. I have not read the document.
See, you guys should not host a show about an event if you haven't read the document.
Really?
I don't think the members, honestly,
we break this rule every day.
There was all this jockeying in Washington about who would get to ask questions, and they were postponing the hearings. And my feeling was only let the people ask questions who've actually read the Mueller report.
I agree with that, Tim.
Right? It's interesting.
Tim O'Brien, thank you so much. Of course, with Bloomberg Opinion and driving so much of the smart that we see every day. Right now on the equity markets, John, why don't you bring in Mr. Golub, who has been persistently in the markets through gloom, thick and thin.
Joins us from Credit Suisse, the chief U.S. equity strategist. It's been a while, John. It's great to catch up with you. Let's talk about earnings season so far. What are you looking at? What's your scorecard, John?
It's pretty good if you look at the level of earnings surprises. You have something like three-quarters of the companies beating expectations, and the beats are coming in more than 6%, which is really strong. The level of the earnings growth is quite weak. We'll probably, by the time this is over, only have about 2% EPS growth, and when you take out the buybacks, that's pretty close to zero. But compared to expectations, things are coming in pretty well.
What's the guidance like at the moment for the rest of this year going into 2020?
I think the guidance is fine. But what we knew we were going to get was, comments about trade and potential headwinds. And so I'm not sure we're seeing anything that's out of the ordinary. But perhaps the more important issue here is that the median company, the typical average company portfolio, is doing much better than the weighted number when people quote the S&P.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is simply that mega cap tech is having a harder time with respect to growth, and that's bringing down the averages, even though a typical portfolio manager is doing a little better.
Okay, Investing 101, your most sophisticated hedge fund client or somebody in wealth management at Credit Suisse. I just did a laddered return year to date, 6 months to date, 3 months to date, 1 month to date. And the answer is it's all double digit, pretty nice returns, everything said and done. Do I get out of the market and enjoy what I've done the first 6 months? Or do you stay in the market even if you get an incremental single-digit return to the end of the year?
All right. So, Tom, I'm going to disappoint you a little bit because I've super bullish for the last 6 years. And I'd say it's not that I'm bearish, but I'm more cautious. If you look since the September high, so roughly about 10 months, the S&P is up only 2%. The reason that the market looks so great since, let's say, late December or year-to-date or the last 6 weeks was because we had such a lousy fourth quarter and we've gotten it back. So stock multiples are fine at 17, but that's roughly where they were 10 months ago. So the market doesn't look particularly expensive, even though it's run up recently. The earnings outlook for next year, you're probably going to get something like a low to mid single digits, which is not brilliant, but is fine. The thing which we really need to see to propel the markets further is exactly what Jonathan was talking about a moment ago. You don't want to be putting yourself out there with respect to equities when the economic data is decelerating. We need that to turn around. The other thing is if anyone believes that falling interest rates are good for stocks, that is not going to be the case between now and the end of the year.
Hey, John, that last line there is not just a throwaway statement from the team at Credit Suisse. I know you've done a lot of work on it, so explore it a little bit further for us. There is this just sort of general surface-level belief that lower rates are great for stocks. What do you know? What do you see in the data?
Well, there's a couple of things. We've mechanically gone through and said, what happens to stocks on days where interest rates fall and days where interest rates rise? And when days where interest rates rise, what you have is better news. And those are the days where the stock market makes virtually all of their gains. This has been the case for virtually the entire recovery cycle. It's a very consistent way to invest. So that's really the simple bottom line. So for people, the reason that the market wants the Fed or is expecting the Fed to cut is because the short end of the curve is inverted. Basically, you can get a higher interest rate on one-month bonds than you can on a two-year bond. But in, generally speaking, if we have lower interest rates at the end of the year, we will have lower stock prices.
John, the value in American banking, you're with a Swiss bank, so it's a little easier for you to talk about this than others representing too big to fail banks. How much of a steal is that cash flow of too big to fail American banking right now?
You know, it's amazing, Tom, that right now if you look at the return of capital, dividends and buybacks together, the U.S. banks are yielding 10%.
Thank you.
And this is an environment where you can get barely over 2% on a government bond. And not only that, but the banks are much less risky today than they've been because the government has forced them to take less risk. So I'm shocked that investors aren't more enthusiastic about this.
And what's so important here, John, is yesterday Gabriela Santos of J.P. Morgan was saying blended SPX is a 2% share buyback. And Mr. Golub just said the bank, too big to fail banking sector, is a five factor of that.
Well, they've been juicing EPS with the buybacks.
Huge.
We saw that with the results just the other week. John, talk to me about the financials at the moment and the lower rate story. The Fed on the brink of an easing cycle. I don't know how deep it goes. It could be one cut, two cuts, three cuts, four. Mm-hmm. That kind of environment, what does it mean for U.S. financials now, considering the shift they've made to their business models in the last decade?
Well, and it's a great point. First of all, and this is a big difference between U.S. banks and non-U.S. banks, is the U.S. banks make more of their money from fees, which means that they hold up much better even in environments where interest rates aren't kind of working in their favor. But what right now, if you can get a higher interest rate on a one-month CD than you can get on a two-year government bond, it's very hard for banks to make money when their borrowing costs, which are deposits, is higher than what they're going to lend out for 2 or 3 years. So if the Fed can brings down the short end of the curve, or a short end of shorter-term interest rates, then bank profitability should do well. So what the banking sector wants is a steep yield curve where the 10-year bond is above the 2-year yield. And that's what the market's expecting. The reason the market's expecting four moves is because they do not believe the Fed will let the curve stay inverted at the short end.
It's there right now, 205 on the 10-year, 1.81 on the 2-year. Jonathan Golub, Credit Suisse, thank you so much. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.